Shop Maniacs, you are listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show. I'm Dave at home with the kids. Rupert with me is Chris in the booth choir. Hey, Chris, how are you?
Darn right. I like our repetitive intro. It just keeps being true.
For these times, until I have bandwidth to be more clever, this is what we got going through. Next 500 episodes is going to just be this. Chris, I got something for you.
Tell me.
This pertains to you, even.
Does it?
A surprise. So remember last week we did a lot of RSS, talking RSS.
Don't regret it.
I don't either. So we're down. I was at like 2,500 when I started and 1,200 or something when we talked last week or whatever. Down to now, well, it was 18 when we started the podcast. Now it's 21 unreads.
Hey.
And I must confess, there are about 230 unread CSS tricks articles in there.
Oh, gosh.
But yeah, I went down and I'm down to like 8. And there's been enough going on that I have questions. And I figured I could pop quiz you on your own blog about your own blog. Is that okay?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I'll do the same to you, just with different questions.
Okay. So,
yeah.
LH and RLH units.
Yeah. Root.
I've never heard of this. This is new. This is like line height units, right?
Yeah, right. But it's now I'm forgetting the exact nature of it. But it's, you know, it's root line height, right? So it's like basing the line height not on, because normally, like, you do, everybody knows you do unitless line height, right? Does everybody know that? If you don't know that, you should almost, I think it's very few and far between that you ever set line height with anything other than just a float, you know, like no unit, like 1.2, 1.1, 1, 0.8, 1.4, 1.8. That's almost always what your line height number will be, because it just means it's a multiple of what's existingly there, right? And root line height is similar. It's just it's just like a rem, in that it's based on the root.
Root, like root line height or whatever. The
is that root. Right though? Now I'm doubting myself.
Yeah, so like root's usually gonna be 16 pixels, but in theory it could be user set and defined, but or if a browser came out at 12 pixels or something, I don't know.
But the thing is, you don't use the LH unit to set the line height. Like, that's too weirdly self-referential. You use the LH unit for something else. And the something else is probably something that matters a lot to inline text. So what's really cool about this is that, like, I don't know, like a button with a login next to it, or like I'm looking at Zoom right now and they got them all over. Like, there's a button in the upper right of my Zoom that says gallery view and it has an icon next to it. And I can tell that whoever set that, I mean, this is probably was written in not web technology, but to get an icon and inline text next to each other is often requires a little hand finicky.
Vertical align minus 1.2 picks.
Yeah, because you always do vertical align middle and then it's not right.
No.
And then you got to nudge it one or something.
Yeah.
Or you do what tends to work is like display flex in a line item center or whatever, you know.
Right. That does work.
That works, but it doesn't size the icon at all. The sizing of it is still up to you. So the big use case for these LH units are, why don't you size the icon next to inline text as 1LH and height 1LH? That means it's not going to size in it. That's different than 1M. 1M is going to be like kind of like the cap height of the text next to it, which is okay, but it's like, it doesn't feel quite as nice as the cap height and the down to the descender.
Yeah, yeah.
It's going to look way more centered.
There's also a little bit of letting above the letter too, right?
The letter,
you know, like, so it's, no, this was very like, I immediately saw, and you have like the example with the icons, you know, it's like, I'm immediately like height 1LH width auto for icons for the rest of my life. If this lands, do you know the browser support for this? Is this something happening or?
I don't, but we could look it up real quick. And that, and credit to the icon idea to Semi, I took this from web platform news. You know, he does a good job of covering new stuff and has a knack for seeing a new thing and knowing exactly the kind of the good use case for it.
Oh, this is in nothing, but so, okay. Very cool. It's in nothing at all, but sure. This is good. Anyway, I think
it's just in CSS4, and because it, you know, we've talked about this before. I think it's fascinating the dance of how things get into browsers. Sometimes they get into browsers because Chrome goes, "This is going into browsers," and then it goes into browsers. Sometimes things go in because a ragtag gang of developers puts in tons and tons of time and effort to convince all the powers that be to get it done, and then they slowly eventually get it done. And then sometimes things just, you know, the CSS working group has this idea for something that they think is good, and it makes it into spec first and then makes it into browsers. So there's always, who knows how things go. But I think that that's good, you know. When something starts at the spec level, I think it's probably going to be like the strongest implementation, you know, eventually once it happens. So this could be kind of cool. Thanks for bringing that up. I was totally, you know, I'm the one who published it, and I was already like, So the RLH is less useful to me, I think. You know, like I can't think of a great use case for RLH, but LH is clearly useful.
Because that's, LH is more like an M. It's based on the current line of text or whatever. And then,
yeah. I mean, RLH, maybe you'd have some like icons in the footer that you wanted to like feel spiritually connected to the document that you would size by RLH or something so that they would scale as you increase the text size at the document level. But that seems like metaphysical.
Yeah. It's like, I get it, I guess. And somebody's going to write a blog post like, why RLH is better than LH. You know, somebody will write this post.
This seems polyfillable too, by the way, doesn't it? At least at the JavaScript level.
Even just like a, post CSS thing. Like if you just set one M and one LH as like, or so, say like width one M and width one LH, you're like, it'll be wrong in a lot of browsers, but it won't be super wrong, if that makes sense. So that's kind of...
Oh, yeah. You would do the fallback technique?
Yeah.
Yeah. You could handwrite that, too. I would in some search.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by Heffler & Co. Welcome as a sponsor. I am stoked about it. They are my favorite type shop out there. The URL is... one of the best URLs you could possibly imagine, typography.com. Nothing is more critical to a good web experience than just clear, clean, attractive typography, which is good news because that's not particularly hard on the web anymore. You know, type on the web has just gotten so good. It's affordable and easy to integrate. Heffler & Co. fonts are the designers of some of the world's most beloved typefaces, like Gotham and Knockout. You know, the CSS Tricks logo? It's just Gotham rounded, all caps, CSS-Tricks. That's it. And I've used it for so long, I feel like it's striking. I feel like it's just coming into its own, really. I really like it still. But all the typography on CSS Tricks is also Heffler Co. fonts. Ringside, Sentinel, Operator. Ringside is the title. Sentinel is the serifed body copy, and I've only been using it now for, what's it been, 3-4 months, and I just love it. In fact, my own team just yesterday complimented me on the typography of the site and said it's really, you know, I've been tweaking it forever. It's finally really beautifully come into its own. It's something I take really serious. And Operator Mono is just my favorite monospace font for code, you know? Really, it was one of the first ones out there that had the kind of slight cursive look for italics, which was just genius and has been copied many times since. I love it. So at typography.com, you'll find nothing but the highest quality fonts. They're screen optimized for the browser, complete families, deep character sets, clever features to help you solve design problems, you know? And then on the site itself, there's free tutorials and stuff to help you become a better typography. Oh, thank God I could use it. Download their fonts to self-host them, or it's $99 a year to get a cloud typography subscription, which lets you use the entire library. for $99 a year. And you get 15% off that if you use coupon code SHOPTALKSHOW at checkout. Just one word, SHOPTALK at checkout. Typography.com/ShopTalk gets you that deal, incredible fonts. Thank you for the sponsorship. Love it.
This, okay, there's a post by Ollie Williams. Shout out to Ollie. Styling the Shadow DOM with CSS Shadow Parts.
So I have mixed feelings on this. Yeah.
See, this is so, I wanted to bring this up. I know Ollie specifically mentions like styled components or, you know, what's your favorite? CSS modules, where it like makes a computer generated hash name to just basically, this is my scoping technique, CSS computer generated classes.
Sure. Yep.
So that's like, but there's this idea of the shadow DOM where you get encapsulated styles in your web components. So if I say my dash element, I can write a style block inside of that that is only going to be used by that style block.
Style doesn't leak out, which is it's a style encapsulation, which is a huge thing that style that web components can do that nothing else can do unless they're doing it artificially, you know?
So it has like a boundary and says you no styles in or out, basically, right? Like
in or out.
So no styles in, no styles out, where it's like an island on your web page. But this part thing is basically you can write like whatever.
Reach in.
You can reach in, like, and it's almost like a class syntax. It'd be like div part equals box space thing is the example you have. So it's almost like a class syntax, but you could say example component :: part box parentheses box background color pink. That's the example you used. So, Ollie. Yeah.
Oh, I see.
It's basically like styling the box part pink.
Well, let's say Dave Rupert made a Dave Rupert web component that had a H1 in it, you know, like a hero. You could put the part as the H1, opening up the styling capability just to that H1. It says, like, I am intentionally opening a portal of styling just to this H1. Via a name. So it's like, oh, it's like an intentional API for styling. And I guess the controversial part to me is that that's so weirdly limited. Like there's no, you don't get nesting then. I can't say the part is the parent component and then I can scope from there and reach in and style children of it. No. It's just the thing that you attached the part to, which to me is like, it's like a little antithetical to CSS, you know, like, that's weird.
Because you destroy the cascade within that. Like, it's only one element. You got to,
Even a basic hero unit's going to have, like, five things in there, probably. So you got to have five named parts with no namespacing or anything. Weird.
Yeah. No, I just was kind of thinking, like, you know, we have this web component for we're using on the Shop Talk site for our audio player. A little bit of work's gone into it. So it would be cool if we like open source that or put that up somewhere or whatever. But the thing is like all the styling is done inside the component. And I just sort of like, I was thinking about like, not everyone wants their audio player to look like our audio player. So how could I offer styling? And maybe this is a way through the part syntax, you know, but I guess my question is like, A, can I use it? But then B, I guess like, is this good? Is this the, I guess this is,
well,
just
you know, there's,
we
you
have,
know what another way to do this is fascinating to me too, is that, CSS custom properties penetrate Shadow DOM. They go straight through it. So another way to set it up would be to pick a bunch of, custom properties, style everything with custom properties, and then just document it. Say, these are the custom properties I use. If you want to set it, if you want to override something, just set these CSS custom properties on like the parent element, and they'll pop right through that Shadow DOM and be used.
But that's like good for, well, that's good for like, okay.
It's the same problem, though. It's not, you can't like, you're now you're setting something really microscopic. You're not saying like, here's just the name of a part. And now because you have the name of the part, you can set the font size, the color, the background. It's unlimited to what you can style. You can't, it won't cascade, but at least you don't have to say, this is, you can just set the color. That's the only thing I'm allowing. Because you'd be like, oh, well, I want to set the color, but I also want to pull in the letter spacing. Then there's, and Dave didn't set up a letter spacing variable. So I guess I'm just poop out of luck, you know?
Yeah, I was going to say like layout and stuff like that. You can't really, you don't get a change, you know, like you're just stuck with the variables.
Right. So part might be better. You're right. Say this is the parent part. This is the play button part. This is the, you know, the slider part. And just say, these are all the parts. If you want to change it.
Right.
Part, style the part.
Process. Yeah,
you're right. Yeah. That is a little better.
I don't know, though. It was all just very interesting to me. Like just this idea of the part. I had heard musings that it was like a thing being built, but I hadn't seen it in action. So this was kind of neat that I don't know. It's neat that that's out.
Doesn't it hang out with theme? I think it hangs out with theme, but I don't understand theme as much.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's colon theme is what I'm talking about. Well, let's just leave that hanging then, and somebody write in and tell us why theme is cool or if it's dead or what.
Write a colon theme post.
Styling of web components though is a that's a thing. It's a thing. You know what? Here's another thing to know about it, though, is just because you use a web component doesn't mean that you absolutely have to do this no in, no out thing. You can just be like, nah, I don't care about that. Just have the global styling affect it. You know, you don't have to make a shadow DOM like that.
Yeah, I guess you can have an open or closed DOM, basically, right? Or
yeah, I forget there. There's a setting where you set it open or closed, and that's not the thing that does it, I think.
Oh,
I forget how this
now
works.
I'm confused.
It's not loaded into my brain, which is an interesting concept by itself. Do you like, not to like, maybe we're done with that anyway, but do you have like a, this is like a big thing at CodePen where we're like, if we're working on something, the way we talk about it is like, okay, well, we're in there, all of us have this loaded in our brain anyway, let's do what we need to do in there, because it's a little hard to jump contexts. You know, if you're in database mode and you're like munging data and moving it around and stuff, and you know, the next project 2 weeks from now also has data munging stuff going on. It's like, it's almost like you should do it all at the same time.
Yeah.
Or if you're like big time in CSS mode, like just stay in CSS mode for a minute, because it's hard to change contexts. You know, you got to reload everything into your brain.
I've been on like icons for like, a month. I don't know. Like, so it's like, you know, it was like somebody wanted like an icon fixed, and then it was like, okay, or like the sizing was all kind of willy nilly, or just enough variance. It was like, let's tighten that up. Okay. Go through, tighten it up. Okay. Now we go through like an accessibility review. Some of the icons at small sizes like absolutely fail. So we have to like go and kind of figure out a ban list or a deny list for all these icons. And then somebody shows up and says, hey, I have like 200 new icons. And it's like, okay, cool. Like, what do I do? You know? So, I mean, literally my yesterday was like sitting through a spreadsheet. I mean, and I just was like, I got to do this all in one day in one shot, because if I show up tomorrow and I'm halfway through a spreadsheet, I've lost it. I've lost it all. So
yeah,
I just,
that's interesting. There's short term and long term too, right? Like you're worried about losing it even after a day, but I feel like isn't there like another version too, where you're like after a week or a month, you're going to, everything related to icons is just going to be,
totally
disposed in your mind.
I have that all the time. I mean, I've learned React probably 5 times. I mean, like, and it's part in Vue the same thing 3 or 4 times, but it's mostly because I'm not using it day to day. And now I have like weekly exposure to like a Vue project that I'm kind of noodling on, but it's not my primary thing. So I can be like at least, conversational in Vue, if that makes sense, sort of like exactly like the language stuff, like Tom Preston Werner was talking about. Just if you don't practice it, like you just don't get it. So, but yeah, I feel like every time I open a React project, it's like all my knowledge is lost or whatever. It's,
I mean, I have an active React project, but I haven't been doing a lot of that. I've been in a lot, you know, for weeks I've been doing like more Node stuff and in relation to some WordPress stuff. And so that's kind of loaded in my brain. And if I had to jump over to do heavy React work, I'd be like, you know, it almost like I don't want to until I can spend at least a couple of days in there, you know? Yeah.
We had a, back in the day, we used to have a, like it costs $5,000 to open Flash or whatever fee. And I don't even know if that's true, but we had contemplated having a Flash fee to open Flash because we were doing so much like web stuff. It, you know, if you showed up and were like, I want a new doodad in Flash or for my Flash site, it would, you know, we'd have to be like, oh my God, how do we do, like, I have to reinstall it. That's like how bad it is, or update all of Adobe at this point, you know? So we had like, we, or at least contemplated like a Flash fee, like just in, you know, because it's a different paradigm at some point, or different enough that you're going to lose some skills. And web components probably falls into that too. I don't use them enough. So I'm a big fan. I'm an advocate for them.
It's smart to do it at the business level, to know that you and your employees are going to have a hard time doing a huge context shift to a new technology. So you're going to charge for that because it's really going to pull their brain into a weird place. Just like early in my thinking about this, but I think there's that. There's like, you know, dealing with yourself and your employees, and then kind of at a micro level too, like how you manage your day. If you accidentally do too much context switching, you're going to be less productive. So being aware of that and not doing context shifting on purpose because you already have stuff loaded into your brain, leave it in your brain.
Yeah, Sophie Shepard has a really good blog post on this. It was The Road to Burnout is Paved with Context Switching.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
It hit me because I was like wanting to write a similar post, you know, and she's in like GitHub management. She's does management, front end engineering management, I think at GitHub. It like had switched over to that, but she was finding like if she was like doing like, you know, a one-on-one, then a big team meeting, and then a this and that, and then like she just like was losing the week or losing a foothold on everything. So her thing was more I'm going to kind of set up these days, like Mondays for thinking and planning, Tuesdays for communicatings and one-on-ones, and Wednesdays are for helping and coaching. Thursdays were kind of hodgepodge, but like she's checked off most of the boxes by this point. So she can kind of, you know, get it, like figure out what's going on. And then Fridays was design and building. So she can just kind of keep her skills sharp. But anyway, that, I don't know if that's sustained. That's 2-3 years ago now, but that post was just, yeah, if you switch context and going from A to B to Z, like you burn out. It hurts.
I mean, to me, I'm just thinking of, it just makes you worse at what you're doing. Like I'm more into like the idea of harnessing, doing a good job. Like if you're there, just stay there for a minute. But that's because I have some privilege of being able to do that sometimes. Like I can, you know, my day isn't as filled with meetings and responsibilities as everybody else.
Yeah. You know, I think about it. Like, have you ever surfed, Chris? You seem like somebody who's surfed.
I literally never once. Sorry.
Never surfed. Okay. Well, so when you're surfing, you know, like I think when you first start or whatever, I'm not a pro surfer by any means. I like popped up once and but like when you surf, like, you know, if you paddle for every wave, you just get destroyed. You're like, if you're like, cause you like paddle, like get over the break, you're exhausted. And then you see a wave and you're just like, oh, I'm going to hit it. And then you just wipe out. And then you have to paddle over the break again. And then you like paddle to get on a wave. Like if you try to ride every wave, like you just get obliterated and you're hurt and out of breath, and it's dangerous, to be honest, because like you could literally drown. But like, you know, and so you see like the good surfers, they just like effortlessly paddle out. They figured out how to do that. They sit out there until a big wave comes, and they know how to find a big wave. And then they say, yeah, I'll ride that big wave, because that big wave's worth my time. Mm-hmm. They don't waste energy. You know, all energy is put towards good surfing.
This is the best metaphor ever. Do you think surfers naturally extend that to their business lives as well? Or
running a skateboard shop and smoking weed isn't, I mean, I think they do. I mean, they just, the minimum effort, man. No, I don't know. I think I wonder too. Yeah. I don't know how it translates. I think it does translate into that lifestyle. Just like, you're just kind of like, I'm just going to do the minimum so I can do the fun part, like optimize my life for the fun part or the part I.
Yeah. That reminds me of Alex Sexton's like, don't like caffeinate a low, but caffeinate when you're already productive, you know, if you can, like to ride those highs instead of fight the lows. You know, I love that. Okay, cool. Do you want to do one more here?
I got another one for you.
Yeah.
So this was a big one. So, you recently posted an art directed post called "What is Developer Experience?" And we've sort of talked about this on the show before, but I think you really like
probably
kind of rounded out the whole conversation.
Well, to me, it came from one place. It came from the positivity of that term versus the negativity of that term. And the positivity is so obvious. It's like we're all developers, and we all care about our experience and probably spend a good part of our lives trying to optimize that experience. I mean, just think of posting a tweet showing off some code and having somebody be like, what's the font? What's the syntax highlighting? You know, like the tip is one thing, but they're almost concerned more about like, ooh, that looks beautiful. I want to have a beautiful coding environment too. Please give me those tips. Because that's what's on their mind. You know, like if sometimes it's annoying, but I think there's some interesting subtext there, which is people are so into like getting their code editor beautiful and learning about the little tools that other developers use and little shortcuts and little stuff. So that to me is like kind of the positive aspect to it. And what I mean by the negative aspect of it is, you know, is largely part of the bigger like client-side JavaScript conversation, although this can apply to any tech, but this is what I know, is that it gets dunked on, like people think of one kind of good DX is heavy, you know, just having a lot at our fingertips in client-side JavaScript and feeling very powerful there as a developer at the cost of how much JavaScript it's shipping to our users. So it's kind of like not caring about UX by caring too much about DX. That's the negative connotation that gets thrown around a lot. And I was like, wow, that's funny how it's the same term being used in very positive ways and very negative ways at the same time.
Okay. So DX can mean like the fonts, the API, the, yeah, you know, or having a CLI you talked about, like,
right,
that for a lot of developers is a huge developer experience bonus. Like, I don't have to like go to a website to configure this. This is great. And then there's often DX is the negative offset or the
highest level version of this is, you know, React is bad for the world because it's only for developers, not for users.
Mm-hmm.
So you gave yourself good DX at the cost of shipping this library to, and I know that has no nuance in that statement. You know, that's not Chris Coyer saying that. I think there's a lot more to this, you know, because the easy response is like, yeah, but it helps us, you know, build really fast. It makes us build these really, you know, it means we can hire really easily and have people to maintain the site. It means there's less bugs on the site. It means once the page is loaded, it's really snappy and fast to jump around it. There's all these positives that come from it. I'm just saying that the easy like axe to throw at that is just that, like, no, that's for you, not for them.
Yeah, No, I mean, I think there's, I do think there's like inherent trade-offs kind of there. But you know, it's sort of like, I think I wrote about this a little bit recently, but not this React specifically, but you know, it is like what's being handed off to the user, a cost or a benefit, you know? And as code users, it's very much like like this is a very much a benefit, you know, or managers, that's very much a benefit, but what's being handed off to the end user, is that a benefit? And you know, I don't know that it's always cut and dry, but it is, I think there are like trade-offs there, you know, like the first question I asked, the develop it who does Preact was just like, how is it so small? You know, you know, React plus React DOM is like 100K or something like that. It's probably gone down in size or gzips up nicely, but it's like 100K. And then, you know, Jason strolls in and is like, well, here's Preact. It's only 3K like ever, you know? And I'm just like, how, you know? And I think there's like a lot of code golfing or whatever that goes on. But then even, you know, he just was like, we are web native. So, you know, we don't have this abstraction for input events, you know? And so that was like, so that's like a big gain there. Cause he's just like, you know, we're not catering to developers who want to go to React Native or whatever. So we've saved a lot of kilobytes doing that. But then you talk to people who have like tried Preact on projects, and if you have a successful Preact project, that is awesome. I've heard stories where people were like, oh, we went Preact and then we had to back out because the community of plugins, the ecosystem, the React ecosystem, the Preact ecosystem, I guess, isn't as strong as the React ecosystem. So
yeah, the second you have one problem that's like, I don't know how to solve this, but it seems trivial if I just switch to the other library, that happens enough times and you're like, screw it, I'm just going to do it. I don't care anymore. I need to solve my problems, not theoretical problems. You know?
Yeah, but I don't know. I'm hopeful, you know, there's one thing people try to straw man, you know, they're like, oh, these, when you talk about the performance hit of React, you're not considering the 300,000 page clicks they're going to do, you know, like that there, they're going to save, you know, and
which may be true,
but I don't think you can, like, unless you have a plan to measure that, you're just guessing, you know,
right.
You're just, you're straw manning and you've come up with a
theoretical benefit. Right.
Yeah. Right. And then I know like some browser people are working on this, like over multiple pages sort of perspective. I've heard some musings, but what's interesting is like, you're like, well, what about over multiple things? And, you know, and you're like, so that's better. And I don't even need to listen to this stuff. And that's like, okay. But you're still guessing unless you have a metric that you're talking about there. Like you're just guessing, you know, like no one's measuring that, you know? So I don't know. So I guess that's all to say, like, I hope we're talking about real things, not fake things. That's what gets me is when we kind of like the theoretical hit to people or something. For me, the trade-off, like, React does have like main thread performance issues. It like kind of jams up the main thread, especially if you have a lot of components rendering. I think it's like based on the number of components, basically, and updates it has to make. But like
interesting waterfall. If you look at CodePen, which is more and more React powered, you know, even the homepage is just nothing will render at all until React has done its job. I looked at an interesting waterfall chart just yesterday where at about 1 second, you know, and I don't know the exact, this is synthetic, you know, this is like a you know, using a performance tool to look at this. Now, 1 second, the CSS is downloaded enough to paint. So it paints, and what you'll see in the waterfall is just gray because that's the background of CodePen. And then at 1.7 seconds, you see the stuff pile onto the page. And that's because React has ran, it's got its data, and it's decided to render. So there's 700 milliseconds there of time. And at the same time, you can, you know how these in these performance charts, dude, you can see like other stuff happening. Like, what's the CPU doing? Well, the CPU is pretty chill in the first second. And then in that 700 milliseconds before the gray and the rest, the CPU is freaking out. It's like doing all kinds of stuff. It's main thread happy because it's just got a lot of work to do. So I don't, you know, I'm not, I don't know what, that's just the nature of the technology. I don't know. There's not much I can do about that, but it is interesting to pair those together. That's what you're talking about. It's like, you know, sure as hell makes the browser busy while it's doing what it's doing.
Yeah, well, I don't want to throw anyone under the bus. I was on somebody's blog, not either of us. I was on somebody's blog today, and like I was on a post, and I clicked to go to like another one of their posts, and my browser just locked up, you know. But I could see a little scrolly happening, and I just assume it's in some kind of JS framework. And so I just was like, man, what's like, how this is a blog. I'm going from like text to text. And when I'd hit the back button, it would just like freeze up again, you know? And I just was like, how's it getting this like jammed up, you know, like an iPad Pro, which is a pretty high end device, you know, like, so it's very interesting. These problems are all interesting. And the post I mentioned, I wrote, it's just about trade-offs. It's like, you know, nothing's free. At a certain point, you've reduced all the complexity. You've taken out all the images or GIFs or what, you know, like you've fixed as much as you can. And eventually you're going to hit like an irreducible amount of complexity. And, you know, the examples I used in the post were like managing scoping styles. You know, you can either do that in HTML or with BEM or something. You can do that with CSS and JS. You can use a utility CSS library, but you're going to start passing bloat around somewhere or the problems, you know, like you go to utility CSS to manage style scoping.
I love this.
Now your HTML is jammed up, you know, like now your HTML is hard to work with. You use BEM. Well, now your CSS just looks like a friggin', looks like a phone book. And then you go over to like CSS and JS. That's cool. But now your JavaScript's all jammed up. Like you're putting a lot into that thing, and that may work for you. Like None of these are free.
You're going to wherever you put the complexity is going somewhere.
It goes somewhere. And even like spacer components, which are a big popular thing, like, oh man, we hate spacer components. That's inaccessible or something. Okay, cool. Like, but they had chunks of spacing pretty efficiently, you know, or you can add to the parent, you know, but now your parent has to be responsible for every single layout that ever could ever show up, ever imagined. Or you like add like padding top and padding bottom classes to everything. Well, now every component needs to accept that. And so if you're like putting it in a CMS or something, now every block in your CMS needs a padding component or padding option, you know, So like the complexity lives somewhere. You're just at some point you're not going to escape it. And the thing I'm saying in the post is we don't exactly make like rational decisions. We make it based on like the experience we had just had. Oh, I just worked with utility libraries. That sucked. I'm not doing that again. I'm doing CSS and JS now, you know, or whatever, you know, like, but I think, I don't know. It's the complexity has to live somewhere. I feel like a lot of these problems, the complexity is going to live somewhere. We have a few tools. I mean, last week we talked about like using the edge, you know, like that's something that doesn't really impact the user. It adds complexity to your life as a developer. Cause now you have the client, the server, and then the edge now kind of doing things that adds complexity to your organization's life. But like the user, like getting a, hey, free trial pop-up banner, if they don't have a cookie, that would be like a perfect place for the edge because the user doesn't have to wait for it. The server doesn't have to like think about it all too much, you know, but the edge could just slip that in there, you know? So
Yeah, it's just moving complexity somewhere else. I mean, hopefully where you've moved it, you're comfortable with, you feel powerful there, the trade-offs are good. You know, there's still a lot to measure about this. It's not just like, it doesn't matter, the complexity goes somewhere, so just pick one. What mm-hmm. you pick still matters, you know?
Yeah, and that's like the second part of like the Tesla's law is which is this complexity can't be reduced at a certain point, but the question is who inherits it and is it a cost or a benefit or a value that's passed on to the user? And so, you know, and that doesn't always, you know, it's not always clear, but then the other question I would ask is like, is this a cost or a benefit? Like what about people who aren't like wealthy or able-bodied or, yeah. you know, like what about those people? You have to consider those people in your metric. I mean, just this week, Twitter blasted out a new feature, dude, audible tweets, man. You can now mouth blog on Twitter, which just sounds like a nightmare. They've obviously never used Xbox Live video game chat. This is just going to go terrible. But the big thing is there's no captions, you know, so deaf users are just left out, you know, just like blind users were left out with no captioning of GIFs and no captions in general. And so it's just this, I don't know, it like awesome. You were able to move fast and you made this thing that made these little videos of audio and stuff like awesome. You made that, but the cost was a cost was passed on to non like hearing users. So bummer, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so
what was, you know, the extra subtext was some of the people kind of doubling down saying like, yeah, of course we want to do that. We're just going to do it later because what, do you not want this until 2022? You know, it was like a little like incredulous, like we ship and then we put accessibility in. That's how the web works.
Yeah.
And I, you know, a lot of accessibility people are like, no, you make it accessible, then you ship it, you know, or you think about accessibility from the beginning. And of course, speaking of dancing, this is the dance we dance. We will dance it forever.
Well, and I think there's good ways and bad ways to play it. I mean, like, you know, even saying like unlocking captions is one of our top priorities is way better than, hey, I got like 8 or 9 things I want to do here, pal. Like, I got a lot of features I want to roll out, my dude. So that's,
yeah, yeah.
There's different ways to approach it.
The one I saw was just Cassidy screaming into it and then saying poop at the end, which is, you know, like shut it down. That's the best one so far. And, but then, you know, some of her replies, it's that you can go to like studio.twitter.com and then upload like you can upload some kind of captions file to the thing and add it. So there's some kind of way to do captions, but it's just a little obtuse perhaps.
Wow. That's
just interesting. Just for journalistic integrity here. Not that we're journalists, but
we'll
try.
Well, that's very interesting. So you can like, they do have a video studio or whatever that they can add.
Yeah. And then there's an article on CS Tricks about this. I forget. Because it's just, that's why I publish blog posts, because then it doesn't matter if I forget, but there is a file format for captions for audio and video.
And VTT, right?
Like, yeah, I don't know, but it's like XML, like I think, and it has timestamps and what's happening at what part. And I think in the case of video, it will actually literally display the captions in the video. Like, you know, well, I don't know if you all turn this on at home, but it's my wife Miranda likes to have the captions on all the time, so that's just the way it
captions
is.
Captions all the time.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but we do. Yeah.
I don't know why exactly either, but I've learned to, at first it was a little annoying and now it's just the way it is, and I don't mind that, cuz it, you know, if you get a little distracted, you get a little more nuance out of it, you know. I think.
Mm-hmm. I think with kids it was like, hey, if we want to watch a grown-up show, we can't watch it at loud volume because grown-up show has loud murders at loud volume.
Yeah.
And so we need it a little bit more chill. And then, but when you do like chill and then the AC kicks on, you're just like, I don't know what's happening. So I think subtitles like bridge the gap there, you know? So
I've heard this is way more popular. Like most people have captions on these days, which just kind of blows my mind, but.
You know, my kids insist on it. Like Otis does, I think because he's starting to read and he just like, I don't know, he'll hear a word and want to know how it's spelled. And that's the easy way for him.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you by Bilsby. Whatever your subscription business, rely on Bilsby for easy and accurate reoccurring billing. It's the most powerful, customizable, and easy to integrate subscription billing software used by hundreds of companies worldwide to simplify revenue operations. Bilsby is a simple, affordable way to handle reoccurring billing for your web application. Don't have your developers do non-core stuff like billing. Let them focus on your core product. Billing handles invoices, dunning, replacement cards, self-service tools, and more for you. You don't even need to monitor usage, as there's a real-time usage API for billable allowances. You can get started with Bilsby and start generating revenue in minutes with drop-in checkout and account management. And it's dramatically easier to scale thanks to features like real-time usage APIs for billing allowances, feature tags to manage access control, and a simple hierarchy of products, plans, and cycles. ShopTalk listeners can sign up with a $50,000 free trial, so you can make the first $50,000 of revenue without paying for Bilsby. There's no credit card required. Afterwards, it's only 0.8% of revenue, no minimum fees. Visit bilsby.com/shoptalk to find out more. That's BILLSBY.com/shoptalk. Our thanks to Bilsby for sponsoring this episode of Shop Talk Show.
Well, we were talking about metrics or performance stuff for a minute, and I have some things that I think would be interesting to talk about there, if that's okay.
Sure.
Well, I think it was either last week or weeks, I don't know, and it all blends together. We talked about Google's new initiative here, which is a big deal because they're not only saying, hey, this is a new initiative for us, but these are the ones that are going to be tied to your SEO, so get used to it. They're called Web Core Vitals, and they're three metrics. LCP, largest contentful paint, FID, first input delay, CLS, cumulative layout shift. Notice these aren't size metrics. These aren't number of request metrics. These are an evolution of how we think about performance. They are like, oh yeah, how long did it take for the thing that matters on the page to paint? Probably your hero image. They got this from SpeedCurve's hero idea of FID is like, how long until I can like type something, until I can like input stuff on the page. Like, is if the main thread's locked up and I can't do stuff, I need to know that. How long till that delay? And cumulative layout shift is like, does your page move all around because you're a jackwagon and load a bunch of ads and didn't account for the space for them and the page moves all around and that's awful and everybody hates it? Yeah, well, you're going to get a bad score then and that's going to hurt your SEO. So it's just those three vitals. What I think is really interesting about these is that one and three, LCP and CLS, you can do synthetically. You can like load, you know, you can just load the page and watch it and see how long it takes for the largest area to paint and see if there's any shifting while it's loading and get a metric and then you know it. First input delay, you can't. First input delay, you like need some JavaScript on the page that's can do stuff and watch for that delay so it knows what's going on. And that brings up this kind of interesting idea that's, you know, a little new to me in my thinking about web performance, is that some performance can be done synthetically. Synthetically meaning, you know, like Lighthouse runs and it gets some metrics and it shows them to you. And some performance monitoring cannot. It needs to be like monitored in real life. And they call that RUM. Right? Have you heard of that?
Yeah,
real user monitor metrics.
Yeah, monitoring.
Metrics or monitoring or something. And that requires you having some JavaScript injected onto your page so that you can measure stuff for the purpose of analytics watching. And it tries to be chill about it, deferred, async, you know, being very, not trying to affect the performance while measuring the performance. I don't know how perfectly it does that, but I think it's pretty darn good. And with that on the page, then you can measure first input delay. But this brings up a couple of interesting things. It's not just those, but think about largest contentful paint. That's just algorithmically trying to figure out, hey, what's the most important thing on this page and measuring it. Well, you don't, that's nice, because when Google does this and says it affects your SEO, they have to do it algorithmically. They have to just assume that the world is not going to help them and they're just getting these metrics very generically. But LCP doesn't, maybe not matter as much to me and you measuring one individual website. What I think is cool about analytics, and I was talking with Mark at SpeedCurve about this, they have some tools for this that's really cool. You can put an attribute on an HTML element that says, this is a big thing on the page that's important to me. This is my hero graphic. This is my editor page. This is my first tweet on the page. This is something that matters to my company. I want the measurement to not be LCP. I want it to be this frickin' image, this element. And you just put the attribute on it, and that's what it measures. So that can be your performance metric. There's another thing. There, you can fire off a JavaScript event that says, okay, the JavaScript is loaded. The most important thing in the JavaScript lifecycle of this page has now happened. Measure that. Measure how long it took for that to happen. That's awesome. You know, for us, it'd be like, okay, the editor is now ready to work. So we write one line of JavaScript that fires off that analytics event. And now our analytics aren't generic anymore. They're not just like, measure synthetic everything. It's like, how long did it take for that important thing to happen on my website? Mm. And I think that's, so we're talking about performance analytics. This is how you would think about other analytics on your website too. Like, I don't care. And like, when you're integrating analytics on your website, you're expected to add events that matter. I bought a pizza. I uploaded an asset. I wrote a tweet. I liked a tweet. I uploaded a photo to Facebook. Those are events that happen. And when you're using analytics software, you're expected to write a little JavaScript in your app that says, that event happened, please track it for me. And, you know, you can do a good job with that. The idea is to do it anonymously and carefully and, you know, but everybody does this. You track the events so you can make your software better, so you can know how people are using your software. That's expected in that type of analytics. But I like lifting up and using that same type of thinking for performance analytics too. Don't just do everything generic, you know, just, I don't know, just synthetically monitor my stuff. That's all I care about. Doing a little bit more effort and putting in these, like, what painted and when? When is this JavaScript thing done and useful, requires very little effort and then gets you way better, more interesting analytics, you know?
There's a lot you could do. I mean, because I tend to, you know, just think about like, okay, when's the, like, when is it painted and when is it usable, you know? But, you know, there's stuff I don't know, like how long does my CSS take, you know, like, or how long does, you know, whatever my web fonts take, you know? I think I had that post about where I added 33 seconds to do oopsie doopsie on a web font, you know, like there's problems can arise and you don't really know it, but they happen, you know, you move two things and now three things are broken. And so, like, yeah, I don't know. It'd be interesting to see what the, like, I'd be curious to see how people are extending it. I see it very much in like your, you know, like when does the discovery or like the most popular feed show up, or when does the like editor load? Like, how quick can people enter code? You know, or when is the editor?
Doesn't it
focused,
seem obvious, you know, now that that's what you should be doing?
Yeah,
I feel like yes, of course. It's like kind of like the only analytics that matter, you know. After
it's
a while,
kind of like top tasks. Not to get Jerry back on the show, but you know, it's like, what's the thing that matters? Just like, look at that, pay attention to that, you know? And
right now you have to care about Web Core Vitals too, because it's SEO. So you kind of have to care about those, but then beyond that, then with your team, you should think about what matters. Say if you're a news website, well, the thing that matters is how fast did the headline and the copy render? So measure that. Which is really easy. These companies like SpeedCurve have made it tremendously easy. You put a freaking HTML attribute on it. There you go. You're tracking it now. Yeah. Do that. I love that. I just love it. I think it's so interesting. I've been trapped in synthetic thinking forever. How many requests? How long, you know, like how big are the images? Are you optimizing the stuff? Is it cached? All stuff that matters, but they're red herrings, you know? They only matter because they affect the metrics that people actually care about, the perceived performance, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You can get kind of tied up in these like fake or just misleading. There's, if you want to do some research, McNamara fallacy is what it's called, but it's Robert McNamara. He was the Department of Defense, whatever that guy's name is. He's the director of the Department, Secretary of Defense during the Vietnam War. There you go. And he was basically like looking purely at like kill death ratios. Like, are we killing, which sounds terrible and very, but that's what he's looking at. He was like, are we killing more bad guys than our guys are dying? Yeah. You know? And if we are, then we're winning, you know, we're going to win. But he wasn't paying attention. There's a lot of things he couldn't see or couldn't measure. Like he didn't understand that they were fighting for their like homeland and their, you know, and they would do anything to like protect their land and their, you know, freedom, which was communism in this circumstance, you know, in the Vietnam War. And he had success with like data driven stuff in World War II, but then in the Vietnam War, he just kind of got blinded by his own data. And, you know, obviously that didn't go well. And a lot of people lost their lives and a tragic number of people. It's an interesting, like,
So in this thing, it would be like if you only cared about your JavaScript bundle size, you're kind of like missing the forest for the trees.
Yeah. Let me see. McNamara fallacy. It is. Okay. So here
I just explained a metaphor with another metaphor.
Yeah. So the fallacy comes from Daniel Yankelevich, that sounds like a fake name, but about corporate priorities, a study of new business demands. And it basically is summed up as this. The first step is to measure whatever can easily be measured. And that's in every business book. That's in Measure What Matters John Doerr or whatever. This is okay as far as it goes. The second step is disregard what can't easily be measured or give it an arbitrary quantitative value. And that's like the synthetic stuff you're talking about. This is artificial and misleading. The third step is to presume what can't be measured isn't really important. And this is blindness. So again, back to like the whole user DX experience is like, we don't really have great ways to measure DX or UX or whatever. So if you just ignore those things, like you're blind. And so the fourth step is to say what can't easily be measured doesn't exist. So if you can't measure it, it doesn't exist. That's suicide is what the McNamara fallacy says. So anyway, it's all very interesting in just the historical context too, of like, this guy who had success following data in World War II, then did data in World War or Vietnam War and it failed him. He did not.
What's funny is he had one final, you always kind of have one final metric. And for him, it was like winning the war or whatever. And so hopefully what you're measuring and all this stuff is like in service of that. Although this is twisted, I realize. And so here's one from, we can probably end with this because it's been a hot minute, but yeah. We just released a new feature at CodePen. This is really cool. You might even like it, Dave. We've been working on our assets a bunch. So the assets feature has gotten a lot better on CodePen now, uploading assets and using them and stuff. So that's been out for a little bit now, right? But let's say you got, you know, an avatar of your face, Dave, or something. But it's big. It's 2,000 pixels. Big deal. You know, CodePen will take it. Drag and drop it on the CodePen, I'll upload, and you'll get it, you know? it's been gotten a lot better recently, and you can crop it as you upload it, and you can upload lots of stuff at once, and there's some interesting stuff that happens. But okay, fine, it's uploaded now, you have a URL for it. We recently changed the URLs for them too, and that they're, it's a much nicer looking URL, and it's, we put a CDN in front of it, so now it's all it's faster, and it's, you know, your Australian users, instead of it coming right out of a bucket that's in Oregon here, it's on a global CDN, which is like, wow, took your time there, didn't you? Yeah, sorry about that. Well, it's good. And then we can intercept the requests along the way and make sure that they're like, for sure, 100% of the time have the right cores headers on them. The headers aren't cached, yada, yada. Text edits or text assets are easily editable, yada, yada. So I'm giving this pitch, but here's what just shipped yesterday.
Oh,
is
boy.
That at the end of an image URL, you know, like dave.jpg, you can now put URL parameters to control the image. You've probably seen this before. Netlify offers it, Cloudflare offers it, Cloudinary offers it, whatever. But you just, at the end of the URL, you just put, you know, question mark width equals 200, and then it'll serve that image as 200 pixels. You can say format auto at the end of it, and it'll just try to serve it in the best possible format, which is WebP. It'll try to, but if you're in Safari, it will know that you're in Safari, and it won't. It'll just serve it as whatever the original was. You can crop it, kind of, you know, because you can scale it and say crop it in this particular way. You can rotate it. You can, you know, there's like eight things it can do or something like that, and it's just through URL parameters. Okay, so that's. Wow. Cool, right? But we want to know like how there's product decisions that go along with this that have to do with analytics and this kind of McNamara idea, right? Of what our final metric at CodePen is and always will be, can we get you to go pro and can we get you to stay pro or even upgrade pro plans? I want you to be pro on CodePen. So you get this feature if you're pro, and you don't if you're not pro, because you just don't have asset hosting at all, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, fine. Like, and then we are considering all this other stuff along with this feature. So here's another sub feature of this. You're not just playing with the URL. We built a whole UI around this. So you can drag sliders, you can turn on and off checkboxes and all this, and it's manipulating the URL and showing the image of what's happening at once. So you click a button to rotate it, it shows you the rotated image. And then there's a button that just says copy the URL. You know, like you've done it, you've manipulated the image. We've shown you a preview about it in real time. We've also showed you how much more optimized it is than the original that you uploaded. It's really neat. There's another button that says save this as a new image. So then you click that and it re-uploads it again to your bucket, but with all those manipulations in place. And before the shipped, I was like the guy, the, you know, Captain CodePen dad who's tried, swooped and pooped on it. And I was like, you know what? Why do we even have this? Like, it's so much cooler to use just the URL format, because then you can manipulate it on the fly. Like, why would you want to save a new copy of the image? But you know what that was? That was me just being McNamara or whatever. I don't know that. I don't know how this... I was just guessing that that's a good idea. I didn't.
Yeah, you don't have the data, so you just say it's not important. You don't.
Yeah, and then even if I wanted the data, where would I get the data? What? How could I possibly track this all the way up to... Did I convince you to go pro and did you stay pro because of it? Like, even if I can track some usage data, that doesn't tell me that. And, you know, somebody made up a good point. They're like, well, we also have storage. You know, like if you upload the image again, that's a new URL. So in some kind of weird way, it gets you to stick around CodePen maybe a little more, because not it's all the more URLs you have that are different. You know, it's not just this one graphic you need to move now. So maybe they're right. Maybe you will stick around more because you have more URLs that are hosted on CodePen. I didn't even think of that. And I don't have any data anyway. So it's kind of like interesting, you know, like my guess is not the thing that should inform whether we should have that feature or not. And even if we track it, the tracking is complicated, you know, just because somebody used one feature doesn't mean that it's necessarily going to make them a stronger pro user. It's just interesting.
No, it is. Well, and then they even just, there might be data where like you could figure out what core features pro users use. You know, you could like, okay, not a lot of people are duplicating or re-uploading assets, you know, but a lot of people are editing assets, or a lot of people mm-hmm. are you know, private pinning, I'm sure, is a huge one.
Right.
Because that's 90% of my pins. So like, you know, like, and so that might help your decisions in terms of like, oh, okay, we see the kind of features that people like. So like private pins are very popular. What are other private features we could develop or something like that? You know, like I think there's a lot of, I think data helps, like data informs, right? I think I've read about this recently, but like data informs, but it shouldn't drive the decision, you know, like
that's a good way to think about it. Like you should have the data, but it doesn't mean that you have to blindly follow it. You know, there's still a heaping helping of intuition involved.
I mean, you know, there's a lot of like, you know, like A/B test stuff, you know, like it, you could actually, you know, make it go down, but you know, like, I don't know, but if like you, but if you know, like you're shipping less code or something, like, you know, just know it's like better, like me, or it's gets you on a step to like to be better. Maybe it's worth it. I can't run your business,
I like your thinking there. No, I like it. I think that's smart. You know, it's just, you know, I think that's how we do it anyway. Like we try to get as much data as we can. And then I don't think we've ever made a decision that was just like, well, the data says this, so do it. I mean, for one thing, you're right about pro or privacy. That's the top seller in every metric, in usage, and as if you just ask people, if you interview people, all that stuff. And we have ideas for it, but all these years later, have we let that guide 100% of our development and said, oh, we're just going to make privacy better on CodePen? No, we haven't. So, whoops.
But maybe it's like, it's possible, you know, like, and this is where like the research and all that, it's possible the feature's perfect as is. Like, it's just the right amount of privacy. Or it's just the right amount, you know, like.
Yeah, that's true too, right? Like, why mess with it if it's working well?
But maybe there's just something, maybe there's one more brick to unlock or something when you start untangling that. Or, you know, have you thought about audio code pens?
ShopTalkShow.com.